both a compliment and a curse when your colleagues ask you to treat them. All surgeons feel anxious when treating colleagues. It is not a rational anxiety. Their colleagues are much less likely to complain than other patients if things go badly, as they know all too well that doctors are fallible human beings and not entirely in control of what is going to happen. The surgeon treating a fellow surgeon feels anxious because the usual rules of detachment have broken down and he feels painfully exposed. He knows that his patient knows that he is fallible. He examined my retina again. The light was especially bright, and I flinched a little. "There's fluid starting to build up under the retina," he said. "I'll operate tomorrow morning." I walked out of the building 20 minutes later in a state of panic. Rather than take the tube or a taxi home, I walked the 6 miles back to my house, rehearsing all the terrible things that might happen to me, starting with having to abandon my career. I did, in fact, know 2 surgeons who had had to do this because of retinal detachments, and going on to complete blindness, which was possible since I had been told I had early changes predictive of detachment in my other eye as well. I cannot remember how my thoughts ran as I walked, but to my surprise, by the time I got home, I was strangely reconciled to the problem. I would accept whatever happened, but hoped for the best. I had forgotten that I had turned off my mobile phone when in the clinic, and I shamefacedly found a panic-stricken Kate waiting at home, fearing the worst, unable to contact me. At the hospital the next morning, a smart receptionist was expecting me. The paperwork was quickly dealt with, and I was taken to my room. The porters and attendants wore black waistcoats like page boys. The corridors and rooms were all carpeted and quiet with muted lighting. The contrast with the large public hospital where I work couldn't have been greater. The surgeon re-examined my left eye and told me that I needed an operation called a gas bubble vitrectomy, in which several large needles are inserted into the eyeball. The vitreous jelly is sucked out, and the retina plastered back into place with an ice-cold cryoprobe. The eyeball is then filled with nitrous oxide gas to keep the retina in place for the next few weeks. You can have the operation under local or general anaesthetic, the surgeon told me in a slightly hesitant voice. It was clear that he did not find the idea of operating on me under local anaesthetic appealing, and neither did I, though I felt a coward when I thought of how I subject many of my patients to brain surgery under local anaesthetic. "General anaesthetic, please," I said to his evident relief, and then his anaesthetist, who must have been waiting outside with his ear to the door, bounced into the room like a jack-in-the-box and quickly checked my fitness for an anaesthetic. Half an hour later, dressed in one of those absurd gowns that for some obscure reason fasten at the back rather than at the front, usually leaving one's buttocks exposed, with paper knickers, white anti-embolism stockings, and a pair of well-used slippers, I was being escorted to the operating theatres by one of the nurses. As I walked into the anaesthetic room, I almost burst out laughing. I must have walked into operating theatres thousands of times, the all-important surgeon, in charge of his little kingdom. And here I now was, as the patient, dressed in gown and paper knickers. I had always dreaded becoming a patient, yet when, at the age of 56, I eventually did, I found it remarkably easy. This was, quite simply, because I realised how lucky I was compared to my own patients. What could be worse than having a brain tumour? What right did I have to complain when others might suffer so much more? Perhaps it was also because I was using my private health insurance and so avoided the loss of privacy and dignity to which most NHS patients are subjected. I could have a room to myself, with a carpet and with my own loo. Details that are very important to patients, but not to NHS administrators and architects. Nor, I am afraid to say, do many doctors care about these things until they become patients and come to understand that patients in NHS hospitals rarely get peace, rest or quiet, and never a good night's sleep. I was anaesthetized and woke up a few hours later back in my room with a bandage over my eye, completely pain-free. I spent the evening drifting in and out of sleep, watching a fascinating light show in my blinded left eye, enhanced by morphine. It was as though I was flying over a pitch-black desert at night, with brilliant fires burning in the distance. It reminded me of watching bushfires at night when I had worked as a teacher in West Africa many years earlier. Long walls of flame, driven across the savannah grasslands by the Harmattan wind off the Sahara, burning on the horizon beneath the stars. The surgeon came to see me very early next morning on his way to his NHS hospital. He took me round to the treatment room and removed the bandage from my left eye. All I could see with it was a vague dark blur, a little like being underwater. "Bend forward and hold your watch close up to your left eye," he said. "Can you see anything?" The face of my watch, hugely magnified like the moon rising over the sea at night, swam into view. "Yes," I told him. "Good," he said cheerfully. "You can still see." I was effectively blind in my left eye for the next few weeks. The gas bubble in my eye was at first like the horizon of a great planet over which I could only see a thin glimpse of the outside world. It gradually shrank and vision slowly returned. The inside of my eye was like one of those gaudy lava lamps, the bubble slowly rolling and bouncing whenever I moved my head. I was unable to operate for a month, but rather reluctantly started doing outpatient clinics a week after my own operation. I found it quite tiring. I wore a black patch over my eye, which gave me a nicely piratical look, although I felt a little embarrassed that my patients could see that I was not in perfect health. When I went to see the eye surgeon a few days after the operation, sporting my eye patch, he looked dubiously at me. "Drama queen," he said, but otherwise reported himself to be happy with the state of my eyeball. I had fully recovered within a matter of weeks, but one of the consequences of a vitrectomy is that the lens in the eye becomes progressively damaged and needs to be replaced. This is a simple, straightforward operation, more commonly carried out for cataracts, which I underwent 3 months later. I was on call for emergencies for the weekend after that second minor operation. If it had not been raining on the Sunday afternoon, perhaps I would not have fallen down the staircase and broken my leg. Perhaps my eyesight was still out of true. After a busy Saturday night, Sunday morning was quiet. I had had to go in to operate at midnight since the on-call registrar was new and had needed help with a relatively simple operation on a middle-aged man with a cerebellar stroke. The operation had gone easily enough, and I spent Sunday morning, feeling rather tired, working in my small, overgrown and ramshackle back garden. I had driven to the Wandsworth recycling dump with plastic bags full of garden refuse and joined the queue of polished estate cars and SUVs waiting to take part in this Sunday morning ritual. Into the huge containers of the dump, people were busy throwing rubbish, the future archaeology of our civilization. Broken armchairs, sofas, washing machines, hi-fi equipment, cardboard boxes, beds and mattresses, last year's lawnmowers, pushchairs, computers, televisions, bedside lamps, magazines, plasterboard fragments and rubble. There is a furtive, guilty air to these places. People avoid each other's eyes like men in a public toilet and hurry to get back into the privacy and luxury of their shiny cars and drive away.